Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome in. You are listening to the weekend edition of the KE Report, a special Easter long weekend edition with myself, Corey Fleck, as your host for the first hour. We're going to start off by talking about some of the economic data that we've seen and some of the internals for the markets, as well as a little discussion on stagflation. And then we are also going to touch a little bit on the precious metals, which are getting sold off, especially when you look at the stocks. I am kicking off the show with Mark Chandler. He is the managing partner over at Bannockburn Global Forex. Mark joins me pretty much on a weekly basis to recap and also look ahead to some of the economic data and some of the major news events that impact these markets. First, Mark, a quick review of U.S. data. The retail sales number came in 1.6% in March. This is the best in 1.5 years. You and I were talking before this retail sale number came in, and you said, you know what, you do expect it to rebound. Please share what this retail sale number means for the U.S. economy and now also what's right around the corner, that Q1 GDP.
So the retail sales, I think, it blew away everybody's expectations. So the U.S. economy, the consumption is really divided into like about 13 retail categories. Of those, 12 of them increased. The only one that didn't, kind of interesting, maybe there's a stock play here, is sporting goods and hobby stores. But part of the reason that the retail sales came in so strong was because of autos and gasoline. So I know you're paying a lot of gasoline where you are. In the U.S., average gasoline prices rose 3.5% in the month of March. That, coupled with the increase in auto sales, the most in 18 months, really lifted the number. If you would exclude autos and gasoline, U.S. Retail sales rose 0.9, which is still a very healthy number, and that follows a 0.7% contraction in February. As you know, retail sales is about 40%, a little bit more than 40% of U.S. consumption. And that U.S. consumption, of course, is like 70% of the U.S. economy. Kind of interesting. The U.S. consumer sector, as a percentage of the world's GDP, is roughly the same size as the Chinese economy. So that's why this consumption number is so important, not just for the U.S., but for the world, but for the U.S. People are going to be revising up their first quarter GDP estimates. We're talking about the, besides the private sector, the bank economists, the Atlanta Fed has this GDP Now tracker. So rather than forecasting, it just takes into account the data as it comes in. It began the quarter very pessimistic, right? We had the poor weather, the government shutdown. They began the quarter near 0.3. After today's retail sales number, they're talking about 2.8% first quarter GDP, and that's coming out next week. The market's not quite there. The market's probably closer to 2.5 or so, but this is a retail sales. People are boosting their forecasts.
Well, one quick comment about the gas prices in Vancouver. We're touching about $1.70 Canadian per liter, so that's pretty frustrating. But back to that U.S. data. When we do see that GDP number next week, and quite frankly, it is going to come in over 1%, maybe even over 2%, how much does that throw in the face that argument of a recession being right around the corner?
Yes, I think people are going to be rethinking that. But the argument would be something like this. A recession was near, but then the administration talked the Fed into changing their views, and so that about-face by the Federal Reserve, that drop in interest rates, is what pulls us back from the edge of the recession. So they don't want to tighten policy. You know, just a week or so ago, President Trump was talking about wanting more QE. And his main economic advisor was talking about the need of a 50 basis point cut. I think that, you know, the market's been a bit slow to adjust to this, but stocks are near record highs. S&P 500, very, very close to record highs. And yields, you know, we've really struggled. Our 10-year yield has appreciated, has gone up 25 basis points roughly from the lows in late March. but it's still struggling to get above 2.6%. We're looking at the U.S. economy with roughly, say, 2% inflation, 2.6 on the 10-year. That means 60 basis points of a real yield. Still very low and still net-net stimulative for the economy.
Well, one thing to consider, too, is yields up to kind of that resistance level, and also the markets, they're unable to break out to those all-time highs. I talked about it a fair bit at the tail end of this week, or at least middle to tail end, and that is low volume, low volatility type of week as these markets came close to those all-time highs. Why don't you think on the back of some of this better data that we didn't see a bit more optimism come into more of the equity markets?
Yeah, well, I think that partly we've come quite far. And what I find happens is that the stocks typically, it seems to me, rally before their earnings and then consolidate or retreat a little bit after earnings. What inspires me, though, I'll tell you, is that the stock market, the S&P 500, gapped higher last Friday. And Thursday, we pulled down to close that gap, and then we bounced off of that. So I think that the market is still technically intact to still make a push for those new highs. We're not there yet. I think we've come a long way, and I think we've had some story stock issues, whether it's Boeing or Netflix. One story or another, it seems like has dominated the headlines. But then I think the S&P rally is still intact.
What about the U.S. dollar, too? It climbed on Thursday, closing in on that recent high at 97.67, only about 20 points off of that. Obviously, that's due to some of that weak data in the Eurozone that we will get to. But do you see that dollar just continuing higher? Because, quite frankly, U.S. is one of the, if not the strongest economy of the advanced economies.
Yeah, no, I'm still in that camp of divergence. You know, I see some things that make me worried, and that's why I think that we have to, as investors, we have to be prudent. We have to be really good risk managers. But I think the fundamentals are still in the favor of the U.S. I see that that in the futures market, for example, the speculators, the non-commercials, have a very large short euro position. I see a lot of people still resisting it, but there's still these different kind of things in the options market also reflect people getting nervous about this, how weak the euro is right now. But I still think we're going to have ways to go because the U.S. economy, while we're talking about modest, moderate growth, both the Eurozone and Japan still haven't turned the corner yet. And I think that's what the flash PMI showed.
Now let's talk about those flash PMIs out of the Eurozone, 51.3, that was lower than estimates of 51.8, and it showed some weakness in the largest economy in Europe. Care to dive into some of these numbers, please?
Yeah, so the flash PMIs, the reason that they're interesting is because they are an early look at how the economy they're doing, and sometimes the ECB refers to them. So there's the soft data surveys and the hard data, like economic data, like production data and that kind of thing. These are survey data, and they're usually pretty reliable. And so what we have is German economy, the German manufacturing sector, and the French manufacturing sector are still contracting. They haven't gotten over that hump, and in Germany, the new business measure, the sub-index, fell for the fourth month in a row, and export orders are still falling. And so you have this weaker manufacturing sector contracting, a slowly expanding service sector, and in this flash readings, we really get the breakdown for Germany and France, and then we get the composite reading for all of Europe. Or all of the Eurozone. And so it looks to me like the market people who put this together are really assuming some weakness in the periphery of Europe that we're not going to find out about until not next week, but the following week when we get the final report here. So the Eurozone, as Draghi has said, the ECB president, the risks to the growth are still to the downside. And earlier this week, one of the things that had pressured the euro was comments from some ECB officials picked up on the news wires, suggesting that they didn't have much confidence of a recovery in the second half. I suppose it depends how you think of it, because there'd be some idiosyncratic things, say, in Germany, like the auto sector and a shift away from diesel. But it's also been hit from some foreign shocks, like Brexit uncertainty. It's also been hit by slowing down of China. But what a lot of people, I think, a lot of people know about those, and I don't think a lot of people see the linkages also between Germany and Turkey. And the collapse of the Turkish lira, the weakening of the economy, I think has also been a hit on the German. Those two economies are more integrated than many people would suspect.
So there's even more worries for Germany and the Eurozone in general, outside of the headline ones. And let's just quickly touch on what the ECB could do here, because quite frankly, German yields, yes, they did rebound. They were minus 10 basis points, now about positive 10 basis points. But the fact of the matter is, they're still extremely low, and the ECB never did manage to get really out of that quantitative easing. We have seen China loosen up its credit markets, and that seems to have produced some better data there. Do you think the ECB still has this power to, if they did go all in on that money printing, support their economy?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that monetary policy has probably gone as far as it can. Though, I mean, there are some things that the ECB will do in June. They're going to announce more details about a new long-term lending facility. There had been talk that if interest rates are going to stay low, and by low, I mean negative, for a longer period of time, Draghi has begun a research into should the ECB be mitigating some of the negative impacts from this. And one way to do that would be to exclude some deposits at the ECB from negative yields. Right now, the ECB basically charges almost everybody 40 basis points for the privilege of them holding your money. And there's some talk that, well, maybe you exclude certain types of deposits. And this is kind of interesting because there's five central banks in the world that have negative interest rates. Three of them have this tiering, which means that you have different levels of interest rates for deposits, trying to mitigate that impact of negative interest rates. The ECB is one of those that do not. And so, but I think that the latest indication from ECB officials is that if they're the mixed opinion, but nobody seems very enthusiastic about it. It might be that nobody wants to admit that we're going to have negative interest rates in the Eurozone for a long time.
Now, isn't that what this type of tiering does, though? Doesn't it, in a sense, almost solidify that negative rates are maybe not locked in forever, but they're a lot harder to get out?
Yes, that's really the quandary, I think, is that on one hand, you say, because the economy has been weakening and inflation is nowhere near their target, you say, well, we're going to have negative interest rates for a longer period of time. So what do we do? Given that, what should we do? And I think that, to your point, that if they do adopt tiering, that it would be another signal that we should expect these negative interest rates to persist. So it's both like cause and effect.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. Now, let's quickly move over to the UK. It was quiet this week in terms of Brexit. That's because the UK Parliament was off, but they're back next week. Do you see any developments here, or is this going to be a story that we're talking about throughout this year and into next year?
Well, I think we're going to be talking about it for quite at least many more months to come. But here's what the amazing thing that's happening is we just got done talking about the U.S. retail sales. Well, the U.K. had a spectacular retail sales report themselves. And this comes on the back of a very robust employment report, too. And what this is telling me is that if it wasn't for Brexit, the Bank of England might be considering a rate hike. And so what I take away from that is that if the Brexit decision could be postponed, that is, if they can get, clear the decks for a long extension, or to make it a softer leaving, like staying in the customs union or something similar to that, that sterling, that once we can get monetary policy back to the fore, so it's not being the oxygen room not being sucked out by Brexit, if monetary policy can come back, then I think you get a case for a strong pound. But the market doesn't expect it anytime soon, and sterling's flirting with 130, which we've broken below a bit, but we haven't really closed below it for 2 months now.
All right, let's jump over to my country, Canada. We have the Bank of Canada meeting next week, and we have seen some generally weaker data in terms of exports out of Canada. Now, I don't think anybody's expecting a rate hike, but maybe more of a dovish pause from that Bank of Canada. Any updates as to what you're going to be watching?
Yeah, and I think that's what, you know, in the dollar block, Canada often gets like grouped together with Australia, New Zealand, and it's interesting now, New Zealand seems to be the most dovish out of the dollar block central banks. They could cut as early as next month. Australia has some strong jobs data, and that keeps them, I think, from easing. But next week we get their CPI numbers, and a soft CPI can weigh on the Aussie. And Canada is sort of in the mix because I think Canada has been, some data has been strong, but the trade numbers were poor. And the inflation numbers, I think, were as expected, maybe a little bit firmer than on some of the underlying rates. But I think that the sort of looking below the surface, I think that Canadian data has been generally, like you say, soft. And the Bank of Canada, I think, has moved from a tightening bias to a neutral bias. But I think they have to soften up that neutral bias a bit more. You know, the market's not expecting a cut. But I think that expectations can begin building for a move by the end of the year, especially if nothing really, if the underlying dynamics don't change.
All right, let's wrap it up here, Mark, with just the general recap. What we're continuing to see is the strongest economy seems like it's the U.S. The markets are knocking on all-time highs. Yields have even started to tick up a little bit, and the dollar's looking strong. Is that the environment we are in for the foreseeable future?
I think so. I mean, specifically with, say, with the Canadian dollar, 133, 134, and every time we try to break out of that, it really punishes people who are playing for the breakout. And I know what that means. I mean, it means that as long as you, the way you can make money by playing that range means you're going to be unprepared for the breakout, when the real breakout comes. And I think that's generally true about the currencies, that many of them are trading in ranges and attempted as market participants to play for the breakouts, but it's been very frustrating. We had our fingers burned many times and we just pushed back in the same range.
All right, we're going to wrap it up there. Mark, it's great having you on the show. If anybody wants to follow along with what Mark's writing about on a daily basis, he does have a blog called Mark to Market. I read it every day. Everybody, stick around. I am going to be right back talking stagflation with Nicholas Pardini. Mark, thanks for your time this weekend.
Thank you. Good luck.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition. In this segment, we are going to be taking a little step away from the markets and talking about this economic concept that is getting thrown around quite a bit. I've chatted about it a fair bit on the show, especially on some daily editorials, but now I'm getting some concepts from Nicholas Pardini, the managing partner of the Davos Investment Group. Also, he writes the Davos Platinum Research. That's his research forum. Nick, what we're talking about here is stagflation. If you look at the definition of stagflation, it essentially is summarized as slow economic growth with relatively high unemployment and a rise in prices or inflation. Let's kick it off with how you define stagflation.
Yeah, I think unemployment really has nothing to do with stagflation. You can have full employment and have stagflation. I mean, you've seen that in several rapidly growing economies. And basically my definition for stagflation is when cost of living goes up faster than real GDP growth.
Which I think you can argue has been happening in the U.S. almost throughout this overall recovery. We've been seeing slow economic growth, but prices the consumers pay, and I know even though the way the Fed measures inflation, that's a bit different than what actual people pay, I'm sure you're going to get many average individuals agreeing with you that inflation has been far outpacing economic growth.
Yeah, I mean, I run my own internal inflation models, and based off of those, we've been in stagflation arguably since the year 2000, with the exception of maybe like the 2007 to 2010 period. But if you use the Fed's, like the standard government measures of inflation, it's probably been stagflation for about five of the last 10 years. Like 2017 and 18, weren't really stagflationary because you had rates going up to keep inflation in check and real GDP had improved, but I think it's going to start to come back again in 2019.
So where do you see inflation standing or even going, I guess?
Well, I mean, right now, I think inflation's held down a little bit by the year-over-year base effects of crude prices, but those have diminished a lot with the recent rally in oil. But I think really, unless if we start to see some real monetary tightening going on, I could see inflation going to somewhere between 3 to 5% in the next couple of years, and you have GDP growth at maybe 1 to 2% and they're in the same time period. I'm not saying what's going to be like the 1970s where you had double-digit inflation and a recession. That's like a more extreme. I think this is more mild stagflation, or I'd like to talk with older clients of mine, Jimmy Carter Light.
So then where does that leave the markets or investors then if it is kind of a muted stagflation, but still inflation running higher than economic growth, and economic growth really stuck in a low range?
Well, I mean, it's not particularly good for investors. If you look at historically, the best markets for investors are when inflation is low, say like 1% to 3%, and the volatility of inflation is low. Like, it doesn't change very much. And we've had, throughout this upcycle in the markets, very low volatility of inflation. Of course, based on the BLS numbers, inflation's been between 1% to 2.5% last 5+ years. That partially explains why the markets have done so well. I expect inflation volatility to heat up a little bit. We've seen that with the CPI and PPI numbers that came out last week, where we got a print of up of 0.6% on the PPI and on the CPI last week, and we're starting to see other costs of things start to go up, or turn back up. Like, housing prices were selling off in some of the richer markets when prior to Powell's dovish guidance, but now those are starting to heat up back again. Crude prices are up from $42 to $65 a barrel since the December lows, and energy and housing combined are nearly half of the CPI index. And honestly, I think those are the two most important things to watch for those who are following inflation, because the cost to house people or to rent office space or retail space, and the cost to transport people and things are the things that are most likely to be passed on to the consumer. Like, if your rent is a certain amount, you can't pay wages less than that, otherwise people won't live in your city. Or if the cost of transporting stuff is too high and it takes up your margin, you're going to have to raise prices to maintain margins or maintain profitability of your product.
So then when it comes, and you even mentioned it there, to central banks or the Fed and how they have been tinkering with monetary policy, you assume, and it does impact both of these factors, inflation and economic growth. How do you see the central banks reacting to a stagflation environment, or do they even notice that that environment is occurring?
Well, it's not severe enough for them to really notice it. And if they do, they do observe this. But basically, we've seen commentary from Fed governors Bullard, Clarida, and Evans, who have been willing to let inflation run high, because based on the Fed's PCE models, inflation's been under 2% for a long time. And so in order to maintain the 2% average, they'll let it run over 2% for a while. So they're going to be slow to react.
They are. But how concerning is that comment that you just made there, where we have heard the Fed talk about inflation running below their targets or just getting to their targets, and them even being okay if inflation started to run over their targets in the sense of averaging out those years when it was under?
Well, I think the complacency level is just not just with the Fed, and I think it's just more broader economic community is towards inflation is way too high. Like, Bloomberg Business Week released a cover of a magazine today asking if inflation is dead. You've seen a general consensus, both the right and the left, in terms of economists saying that deficits need to be bigger, and there's really no risk of increasing the size of government spending or debt. And you're starting to see proposals such as modern monetary theory and universal basic income come into vogue, which would be extremely inflationary, unless if you had major tax hikes to compensate for them.
Which it doesn't seem like we're going down that road, but you are right. This modern monetary theory is all pointing towards what seems like higher inflation. How do also currencies play their role in this? Because, say, the U.S. dollar is rising, that can somewhat keep a cap on inflation, but that's also not what the central banks or even the politicians want.
Well, I think the dollar would be the biggest loser in this environment, but the problem is against what? If the Bank of Japan and the Bank of England and the ECB continue to be just as dovish, if not more dovish, than the Fed on a relative basis, then the dollar's not going to go down. It might even go up on the dollar index. So for those who are bearish on the dollar, shorting the dollar index is not really particularly a good idea.
So does that mean we're seeing stagflation around the world, not just in the U.S.?
Oh, yeah. This is a global problem. It's not just in the U.S.
Can the globe work itself out of this problem?
The thing is there the political will for the globe to work out of this problem? I mean, it can easily be done. You just raise interest rates. But the problem is that, as I mentioned, I think, in a previous conversation with you, with the Fed, it's stuck between the rock and the hard place of, if they raise rates, that triggers higher required cap rates on all assets, and therefore depreciates asset prices and also risks defaults in various more speculative centers of the economy. But if they don't raise rates or cut rates, then you're risking inflation. So, I mean, they're kind of having a hard choice. Like, the asset markets are kind of supposed to be like the confirmation of the Fed doing a good job in recovering the economy, and also there's political factors too in this. And if that goes down, and given how sensitive the modern economy is to financial assets and to debt due to the amount of leverage in the system, the market going down could actually be a tail wagging the dog for the broader economy. And that's really the concern of the Fed.
It is. But isn't that one thing that could maybe stop or put a halt to that stagflation narrative, is if we did get finally that market correction or some sort of a recession to reset some of these metrics? I know it'd be painful, but at least maybe on the back end, we'd come out of it with a bit more opportunity for economic growth.
Well, potentially. I mean, if it depends, like if the recession is associated with massive deflation in housing and energy, which if it is, then yeah, that won't be stagflation anymore. That's just a deflationary bust. But that's not really the outcome that central bankers are trying to target, because their job is to smooth the business cycle, not extend.
Well, they've definitely extended that business cycle for a while now, and I think that's what people are waiting for, that recession or something to happen with that business cycle. How long do you think they can keep that ball rolling, though? I know it's a tough question to ask, but overall, these central banks, I think, have managed to keep the ball rolling much longer than a lot of people thought. And even this week, we started to get better data out of China. We are even seeing yields rise a bit more in Europe. There seems to be, at least right now, a little reprieve of this negativity around global economies.
Honestly, I do not know the answer to that question. I mean, I thought this bubble would have busted years ago, to be quite frank. But, I mean, it basically, they can keep going until inflation gets out of control, even with their numbers. Like, if you start to see CPI printing at 3.5%, 4%, and the market's going to react whether the Fed hikes or not, because inflation erodes the bottom line of profitability of companies, because you can't pass 100% of the costs on to the consumer. You can pass a fraction of them, but if you don't pass all of the entire cost of inflation on to the consumer, that's going to hit you with falling margins.
Yeah, boy, is it ever. You're absolutely right on that. So then in terms of your research then, and I completely agree with you, it's impossible to tell when the Fed or when the central banks will kind of lose control of being able to keep this ball rolling. How do investors stay at least somewhat protected and still able to, I guess, take part in some of the gains that we're seeing?
Well, I mean, given how low volatility is, the best way to probably do that is via the options market. You basically, you cap your downside risk with the premium you've paid, but you continue to get upside if things continue to keep going more extreme valuations. Or you catch the turn if you're more bearish with puts, both defining your risk. So, yeah, I mean, with the volatility at current levels, I think the best way to do that is have a small portion of your portfolio either used as options to speculate on upside or to hedge your existing long assets.
Well, I know a lot of people still trying to pick that top in the market, but a lot of people that are still thinking that that run that started to happen on Christmas or at Boxing Day, I guess, it's taken further than a lot of people thought, and there are some shorts that have definitely got squeezed during this run. Nick, it's great chatting with you. Some interesting concepts on stagflation and where it stands, not just in the U.S., but around the world, and how central banks, it seems like they're just trying to keep that ball rolling, which leads us further and further down this stagflation-light scenario. Nick, great chatting with you. If anybody wants more information on Nick, his investment group, the Davos Investment Group, or his research from Davos Platinum Research, please email me directly at fleck@kereport.com, and I am happy to put you in front of the team around Nick. Nick, thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, I am back, continuing on with the first hour. And in the second half of this first hour, we are going to be focusing a bit more on the resource sector with Byron King. At least in this segment, I'm chatting with Byron King. And Byron, I want to outline a report that was recently published by McKinsey & Company. You sent it over to me, and this report talks about the decline in reserves. So these are reserves on the books amongst the large gold miners. A general decline. We're just not seeing the same amount of assets or reserves being held by these companies. Now, there's a number of different reasons that we will get into, but first and foremost, can you summarize your takeaway from this general report, please?
Yes, thank you. McKinsey & Company just published a very significant, in my view, report. First of all, it's significant that McKinsey & Company is writing a big report on the gold industry, because McKinsey is a large global consulting company. Something like 80% of the large companies in the world use McKinsey, the big banks use McKinsey, governments use McKinsey, NGOs, nonprofits use McKinsey. So when McKinsey is focusing on something and putting out a publicly available report, that's important. That is serious exposure to that particular issue across a lot of different things. I mean, you know, the news media definitely picks up on these kind of things. The title report is, Can the Gold Industry Return to the Golden Age? And, you know, the little subtitle, Digging for a Solution to the Gold Mining Reserve Crisis, you know. So it's what we have here is McKinsey basically saying that there is a gold mining reserve crisis. And in the course of the report, which is, you know, 24, 25 pages, something like that, you know, it's talking about the decline in gold reserves of the gold mining companies. And, you know, it's a very well-done report, a lot of very interesting, you know, points in it. It hits on things that if you are familiar with the industry, there's nothing terribly new here, although their charts are very nice. I do, you know, take a look at a report and, you know, look at the charts and admire those charts. They're talking about the lost value across the gold mining industry. They're talking about the decline of reserves. They have the very familiar chart of how exploration and development has just, you know, fallen off almost a cliff, you might say. It's really declined significantly in terms of, you know, what are people finding. And then, you know, axiomatically, you can't discover, or you can't develop what you haven't discovered, and you can't mine, you know, what you haven't developed, you know. So, I mean, so when the upstream, you know, exploration development pipeline gets choked off, you know, the downstream mining pipeline gets choked off, and they have a nice set of charts in there about how in the last, you know, 7 or 8 years, you know, the total reserves of major gold companies are down 26% since 2012, and the number, the, you know, the total ounces in the ground reserves for the big gold guys are below the levels at 2007. So they're basically saying that there's not enough, you know, there's a declining reserve issue across the gold mining industry. There's not enough exploration and development. And so, you know, with a company like McKinsey, you know, shining a spotlight on an issue like that, I do think that's positive for the sector, because it makes it easier for people inside the sector to explain, you know, outside the sector, what's going on, and it adds credibility to the point that you want to make. Of, you know, it's not just us gold miners, it's not just us, you know, diggers and drillers, you know, with our hard hats and our steel-toed boots out here, you know, complaining about, you know, what's going on inside the industry. And now we've got kind of the holy water of a company like McKinsey, you know, sprinkled on the issue.
So, Byron, one thing that I found very interesting, and you outlined that stat, that these reserves are down about 26% from 2012, but the peak in mid-2012 down to about where price is now, it's about a 25 to 30% decline. So it's almost falling right in that range of where some of these miners would have to write off some of these marginal assets that they purchased back at the peak of the market. How much do you think this decline has to do with the fact that simply we're in a lower gold environment, and due to accounting regulations, these companies can't carry these marginal ounces on their books?
Well, I think we're looking at a double-edged sword here, or you know, getting hit from both directions. On the one hand, the companies are getting slammed by, you know, by accounting rules, you know, the whole mark-to-market kind of thing. You see that in the energy industry as well. You know, when oil was $100 a barrel, there was an awful lot of, you know, marginal oil that was carried on the books as a reserve. You know, when oil was $50 a barrel, you know, I mean, a lot of that oil went away. And so there is that accounting situation. But then when you look, you know, at the nitty-gritty of the industry, of the gold mining industry, or, you know, mining in general, you know, precious metals more in particular, even with the money that is still getting put into exploration and an early stage development in the mining industry, I mean, if you don't find it, you don't find it. I mean, if it's it's one of the reasons, I think, why in the last year or so the market has been so friendly towards companies that seem to be showing a good exploration story. I mean, you know, one or two really good drill holes were able to move a lot of these, you know, junior type companies, just because this sense of hope that, gee, maybe this will be the one that locks into that, you know, the next big discovery. Although, really, when you boil it down, there are no really, you know, really big discoveries being made. Very few. I mean, very, very few. And much of what's happening is, you know, kind of brownfield development. You know, you're going back into old systems that have been, you know, worked over, and now people are trying to, you know, kind of find what's left. There's just not a lot of, you know, brand new, you know, eureka greenfield kind of discovery going on anywhere in the world, really.
But how important is that there just isn't that discovery going on? Do you think that problem is due to governments not allowing companies to explore, especially in maybe some more profitable areas or some more attractive areas? Or is it the fact that all the easy high-grade stuff has already been found and is being mined already?
Oh, man, now there's about six different layers of questioning on that one. I mean, yeah, of course there are, you know, social, political type issues. I mean, it's very, very difficult to explore and develop, you know, new levels of resources in, you know, advanced developed countries. I mean, you know, it's very difficult to work in a place like California, you know, I mean, with the environmental regs, and even, you know, so-called mining friendly jurisdictions, you know, Nevada or Idaho or, you know, the Arizona Copper Belt. I mean, for as friendly as those states traditionally are, I mean, it's still a tough, you know, it's still a tough move, you know, to make things work. You look at a company like Midas in Idaho, for example. It's a permitting play, you know. I mean, there's no question but that the geology is great, and they're going to redevelop an old brownfield and clean it all up. But it's you know, boy, it's just you just seem to wait forever to get the permits. And I could mention other places. Now, other places where you have really interesting exploration going on are extremely remote. A company that I've followed for a while is Sabina, up in Nunavut, you know, way up in the high Arctic of Canada. It's right at the Arctic Circle, in fact, and really nice numbers, really high grade, a banded iron formation, which is a very, you know, it's a very predictable kind of deposit. But, you know, you've got to go that far away in that kind of harsh climate, you know, to find things like that. You go other places in the world, a country like Ecuador, for example. You know, I mean, Ecuador is a beautifully geologically endowed country. I mean, really incredible copper, gold, silver, you name it, mineralization down in Ecuador. But it's problematic in terms of the politics. I mean, you know, they've had a history of anti-outsider, anti-development, and, you know, I mean, the Lundins moved in there. There's a different government now, but at the same time, you've got the national government in Quito dealing with kind of the grassroots resistance out in the field, you know. So, you know, every jurisdiction is different, and which is why, you know, I guess the point to consider here, which is why you have to think in terms of what are we looking for, what kind of numbers, you know, where is it, you know, in terms of the jurisdiction, what's the sociology there, you know, what is the politics there? I mean, you've got to get away from thinking that every geology or every mine development is a geology development, because it's as much sociology as it is geology anymore. And, you know, you bring that whole thing around, you know, you turn that wheel, you know, the rest of the way. And the other side of the coin is that, you know, we're not finding the big numbers, you know. Now, that doesn't mean that this stuff isn't out there. It doesn't mean you can't find it. It just means that it's harder and harder to find it. You mentioned, you know, is all the easy stuff picked over? Well, yeah, all the easy stuff is picked over. You know, I mean, there might be something out there that somebody's going to trip and fall over, but it's all serious exploration anymore. I mean, if this isn't, we're not prospecting anymore. We're in the serious exploration business, you know, and that's what you have to think about in terms of, you know, running an exploration program.
Well, and that's, I think, kind of a distinction of where the money has been flowing in this market. And let's look at it from an investment angle. Obviously, good high-grade discoveries are still getting some attention, but those are fewer and farther between. And as we kind of outlined with the issue of where some of these resources or the grade of some of these resources, quite frankly, we've been in a sideways market since 2013 and still down a fair bit from those highs in 2011 and 2012. I think the argument of this is a bull market is very difficult to make. So then the trading strategy that seems to work in these type of markets is take positions in the profitable miners, even some of those royalty and streaming companies, the companies that make money, even if the price is going sideways. That is where the money's going to flow first when it does finally start coming in a broader sense to these markets. What do you think about that trading strategy? It's nothing new, but it's just more a function of the market.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, we were talking about this before we came on the air here, but when you look at some of the companies that have been hot lately, you've seen a couple of, for example, the Australian miners, guys like Kirkland Gold or Newcrest, you know, that a lot of money flowed into them. Well, a lot of investor money flowed into them because these companies are very well run. They've got high margins. They produce a lot of cash. And from an investment standpoint, from investment metric standpoint, there's nothing wrong with, you know, going into a well-run company that's spinning cash. I mean, you know, just like the old saying that might not be so true anymore, but the old saying was that nobody ever got fired for using IBM, you know. But, yeah, you know, nobody ever got fired for putting money into a well-run company that was spinning cash and had good solid margins. And, you know, whether it's an up market, down market, sideways market, but certainly in the metals market that we've been experiencing for the last 4 or 5 years, you can see why the, you know, money migrates into those plays. when things do start to get better, you know, when we do start to see more of a pulse in gold or silver or copper, things like that, you've noticed that the companies that tend to move the quickest, strongest, are the royalties and streamers. And you know, because you have no mining risk. You know, these companies are incredibly efficient in terms of who they are and what they do. I mean, basically, they have an office with a couple people and some telephones and computers and things like that. They're not running a mine. They don't have to worry about that stuff. They just sit around. They're more like a bank. They sit around and they cash the check. You know, or they have to walk down. They have to walk downstairs to the bank in the lobby and cash the check after the mail carrier delivers it. So those guys tend to move first. But there's nothing wrong with a well-run company while you're waiting for the rest of the market to move. And to the extent that the rest of the market will eventually move, and it will eventually move because it has to, it's just a question of when and, you know, how patient do we have to be and how frustrated will we get along the way. You know, I mean, at least then you're positioned in the right kind of companies. As far as third-party money, that outside money, the big money that's all wrapped up in tech and biotech and, you know, a lot of people out there, they don't know anything about the gold industry. They don't know anything about mining. They don't know. They don't care. They don't want to know. Except, you know, they're going to chase momentum. And when they start to see things move in the mining industry, eventually, where are they going to put their money first? Well, they're going to put their money first in the big, well-run name brand names. That's where they're going to go first. And so if you're there, you know, you'll catch that wave. And then if you know where to go in terms of the top of the list in terms of, you know, the junior explorers, the junior developers, just the well-run companies with really nice assets that have been really market neglected for the last couple of years. You know, if you know where to go, you know, on the second move, you know, of the market, you'll catch that wave as well. You know, I mean, we sort of saw that in the beginning of 2016, a couple of years ago, when, you know, between towards the end of January until about, you know, June, July, you saw these multi bag gains in a lot of the junior type companies.
Yeah, you absolutely did. And I think there is a balance there for when the market really does get going, that you can't just rotate all of your money out of the big guys into the little guys and time it perfectly. So there is an argument to have a position in some of these more well-run miners and the royalty companies and in some of the smaller companies. But Byron, in your newsletter, The Gold Speculator, you write about miners, developers, and explorers. What are some of the companies that you can share with us that you think are in this sweet spot?
In the sweet spot, I mentioned one or two of them already. I mean, a company like, for example, Sabina, which is an incredibly good asset. You know, big numbers, big resource number, really nice grade, and a lot of the hard work I don't want to say is behind them, but I mean, they've done a lot of the hard work to get to where they need to be. You know, they're up there in the high Arctic. They call themselves an explorer, but really they're sort of a junior developer at this stage. But I'll keep calling them an explorer, but you know, because they've got lots more exploration to do. But at the end of last year, at the end of 2018, they completed a pier facility, on a body of water, you know, that accesses their site, you know, up there. And so I was up there talking with the Sabina people, and I said, "Oh, how deep's the water here?" And yeah, they weren't quite sure. They had to look at a bathymetric map, and somebody said, "Oh, it's about 115 feet." And I'm like, "You have a pier next to a 115 foot deep body of water. You could park an aircraft carrier there." You know, in terms of changing the game on their logistics, now you can take a really deep draft ship full of everything you need and sail it up there. And you've just changed the whole logistic equation. Instead of having to fly in every barrel of fuel that you use, or fly in every, you know, pound of food that the guys eat, you know, I mean, it's you've just changed the logistics of that whole operation. There's one. Another one that I think is really due for a re-rating pretty soon. We've talked about this before. Is Victoria Gold, building a mine up in the Yukon. I mean, they'll be stacking ore by July, pouring gold by the fall. I mean, a nice, successful play. Another one that I think is just a really true success story has been Atlantic Gold, working in just near Halifax, Nova Scotia, not too far from Halifax. Beautiful, beautiful piece of geology. You're in Nova Scotia. I mean, you can fly into Halifax. You know, no issues with workforce. I mean, they've a big long corridor of exploration potential and an up and running mine. They're over a year now into commercial production, and yeah, they're still tweaking out the little bugs here and there. But boy, they just get better every every month, every quarter. Their numbers get better. So those are a couple of names on my top shelf list right now.
All right, Byron, good having you on the show. I appreciate that little recap of that McKenzie and Company report, as well as some of the stocks that you are writing up in your newsletter. Byron, thanks for your time and have a great long weekend.
Thank you much. Appreciate it.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition. And continuing on with the second half where we're talking resources, we are getting an update from an exploration company, Great Bear Resources, traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol GBR and on the OTC under the symbol GTBDF. I am chatting with the president and CEO, Chris Taylor. And Chris, I wanted to bring you on because there was news that the company released actually at the beginning of April that is unique in the exploration industry when we're in this market that still isn't a full-fledged bull market for resource companies, especially the explorers. But Great Bear just announced that it is doubling its current drill program from 30,000 meters to 60,000 meters. If anybody hasn't stayed up to date on Great Bear, this is at the Dixie Lake project in the Red Lake District in Ontario. Chris, just take us through what the plans are now that this drill program is being doubled.
Well, thanks, Corey. The main reason that we're upscaling the drill program is that we like what we're seeing coming out of the ground. So all other considerations aside, that's the dominant reason to put on another drill rig. So that means at the beginning of 2019, we had one drill rig going, and that's pretty much what we've been working with as we've been exploring the Dixie property for the past 2 years. In February, we added a second drill rig so that we could effectively drill multiple targets, both on our Dixie Limb Zone and our new high-grade Hinge Zone discovery, and take the rig and use it to explore regional targets as well. And then with the results of that over the past couple of months, we've seen more zones. When we step out into new areas, we keep hitting new areas of mineralization. And of course, the Dixie Limb Zone and the new Hinge Zone discovery, they keep growing as well. And the upcoming drilling that we're doing, it's both along strike, down dip, and testing regional targets. So it just became obvious to us that we needed to bring in a third drill rig.
It sounds like this is still all very much exploration drilling. What's the balance here between exploration and some sort of infill drilling?
Well, there really isn't any infill at this point because we're not drilling between existing drill holes. So that can be a perception when you're in sort of an aggressive delineation drilling program. But we haven't done any infill yet at all. So we keep stepping out into areas that are either down dip or adjacent to parts that we've already drilled, both at the Hinge Zone and the Dixie Limb. And that means that each new fence of drill holes that goes in effectively makes the system bigger. So every time that you see a Great Bear news release, you're looking at the discovery of more mineralization that's adding to the story. So with three drill rigs on the project, one of them will be undertaking true exploration work. This is testing new ideas and new targets in different areas of the project. The other two will continue to step out steadily, like along strike and down dip of the zones that we already know about.
Okay, and I see in the news release that it said that the original program was going to be completed by July. Now this extended program will continue through 2019. Does that mean you're going to be drilling pretty much all year?
Yeah, that's right. We're going to be drilling steadily here without pause. Well, I should put a caveat on that. I think right now we've been for about a week into the spring thaw period. So generally you get 2 or 3 weeks at around April each year when you just have to let all the snow melt and the ground dry out a little bit so that you can get back in. So we're in sort of a 2 week hiatus at the moment with a whole bunch of drill core sitting in the lab getting assayed as rapidly as possible. These would be additional results since our last news release, so we're trying to push those through as quickly as we can. And then as soon as the snow is melted, we'll be right back in there and just drilling very aggressively through the remainder of the year. So yeah, we will be steadily drilling without stop all the way through the rest of this year and into 2020.
Yeah, very exciting, because exploration drilling has really been what's been able to move stocks. And you even look at the Great Bear chart and that whole discovery, and now continued exploration drilling. Who knows? Could lead to maybe even more money coming into the company. Any plans on putting a resource around this maybe after the drilling is done? So maybe extending into 2020?
That's a good question. You know, I get asked that all the time, and I have to come back with the same answer is, right now, you're drilling a gold system that's, it's minimally sort of a kilometer to a kilometer and a half long of every drill hole putting into the Dixie Limb and then the adjacent Hinge area coming back with gold so far. And that continues to expand. So the gold system itself looks like it's many kilometers long, like several kilometers, because we've drilled out step out holes that are up to 2.5 kilometers. And they're all mineralized. So it shows us that we're on top of a really big looking gold bearing hydrothermal system. And we don't know where the boundaries are. We don't know where the boundaries are on strike. We don't know where the boundaries are at depth. So when I get asked the resource question, the point is we are steadily drilling out like grids of holes that expand both the Dixie Limb and the Hinge Zone. And we'll continue to do that. And that means we're adding effectively more known mineralized volume with every single drill hole. I wouldn't be too eager to put a resource out to market before we have a feeling for what the potential size of the system is. Is it 2 million ounces? Is it 5 million ounces? Is it 10 million ounces? I have no idea how to answer that question right now because it's so early days. We've only been drilling steadily for about 8 months. It's one of the reasons that recently we put up a video on our website that shows the growth of the Hinge Zone discovery. It's a little bit of a narrated video that I put together. And if anybody's interested, please go to www.greatbearresources.ca, have a look at that video, and it'll show you just in 8 months with one drill rig how much bigger that Hinge Zone has gotten. And I think that really shows you that we don't yet know how big this system is going to be. Once we have a feeling approximately for what kind of size of entity that we're dealing with, then we can start thinking about resource publication, because I think a lot of companies go to the market when they get their first 1 million ounces or first 2 million ounces. And if that's before they have a feel for how big it really is, you're not doing your shareholders any favors if you're sitting on top of a really big system by showing people a number that's not representative of what there could be.
That's very true. Plus, one thing to consider when you come out with a resource, it's on you to consistently be updating that resource when you are continuing to drill. So by taking your time, you get to focus on actually drilling and, well, seeing just what the potential is here. It's always important to ask where the funding is for this company. Even in the title, it does say fully funded drill program, but take us through the cash in the bank and even some more money to come in thanks to some warrants.
Yeah, that's great. We have about $12 million in the bank right now. And that means that the expansion on the drill program that we're talking about, bringing it up the extra 30,000 meters. Well, because we're drilling right off the side of the highway just outside of town in Red Lake, our all-in drill costs are just over $170 a meter. And that's all in. That's drilling, salaries, all the other costs, assaying, the whole nine yards. So that means that we have an estimated budget of about $5.2 million for that extra 30,000 meters of drilling and a contingency on top of that of a few hundred thousand dollars or $400,000. So we have about a $5.6 million budget for that expanded program. That means even with all the marketing and G&A and the other costs that a company will have, will still go into 2020 with $5 or $6 million in the treasury, plus another $7.8 million of in the money warrants that are owned by, at this point, Rob McEwen and management. So that puts us in a position where we'd have still over $10 million going into next year and the ability to do this scope of program all over again.
Wow. Okay. So you can just keep on drilling. And I know I get this question a lot for pretty much all exploration companies is, can we see a strategic enter the company? You guys are in a unique situation because you have this money plus some strong shareholders. Are you looking at bringing a strategic in, or is this, again, something you can just brush aside while the drilling that is fully funded just keeps going?
Well, the answer is I think they're probably more interested in coming into us than we are of that scenario occurring at this point. What we're looking at here is building value through the drill rig. And because we have the funding to do it, I would just say that we're not in a hurry to bring in an external party. Now, you know, if a party approaches us with an attractive set of terms, then that's obviously, these are conversations that we'll be willing to have. Very early on in the discovery process, we received many of those types of offers. Obviously, it raised a lot of eyebrows. In a sense, Great Bear came out of left field. Nobody was expecting this big, high-grade near-surface discovery to be made just off the side of the road. When it was, we received many of those offers. It just wasn't on terms that we were comfortable to deal with. So we ended up receiving attractive terms from Rob McEwen at the time, and that's why he became involved as our largest shareholder. So going forward, there is a lot of interest in what we're doing and in our company and in the strategic value of what we're doing. So I think what we need to do is just consider these options as they become available and ultimately make decisions based on what's best for our shareholders.
Yeah. Hey, well, Chris, I appreciate this update. I don't think there's too much more to talk about here other than I think we're just waiting for some more results to come out, and we'll keep following up to see how this exploration drilling is going. But overall, Great Bear is in a very unique situation, one of the explorers that is definitely outperforming the market. There's only a handful of them right now. And hey, I really appreciate you taking some time and explaining the developments and the ongoing strategy of the company. If anybody has any follow-up questions for Chris or Great Bear or any of the guests that you have heard on this weekend show, please be sure to email me, fleck@kereport.com, and I will be sure to respond to your email and also try to get those questions answered. Everybody, I appreciate you tuning in on this Easter long weekend edition. Everybody, have a great long weekend. Same goes for you, Chris.
Thanks, Corey.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.